Secret projects on mind control, remote viewing, alien technology, time travel, demonology and black magic, and increasingly esoteric ways of waging war. The strange side of the Cold War is next on Coast to Coast AM. Sean Patrick Hazlett is an Army veteran, speculative fiction writer and editor, and finance executive in the San Francisco Bay Area. He holds an AB in history and BS in electrical engineering from Stanford and a master's in public policy from the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, where he won the 2006 Policy Analysis Exercise Award for his work on policy solutions to Iran's nuclear weapons program under the guidance of the future Secretary of Defense, Ashton B. Carter. He also holds an MBA from the Harvard Business School, where he graduated with second-year honors as a cavalry officer serving in the elite 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment. He trained various Army and Marine Corps and units for war in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's a 2017 winner of the Writers of the Future contest. Over 40 of his short stories have appeared in publications such as the year's Best Military and Adventure, Year's Best Hardcore Horror, Terraform, Galaxy's Edge, Writers of the Future, Grimdark Magazine, Vestrarian, and Abyss and Apex, among others. He's an active member of the Horror Writers Association and Codex Writers Group, and he is the editor of the anthology Weird World War III. Hey, Sean, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for inviting me to be on the show, Richard.
That's quite a resume. I was going to say, you're a kind of a slacker, aren't you? Just kidding.
Yeah, I like to keep busy.
I'll say. What's the difference between a speculative fiction and science fiction fantasy?
So speculative fiction is a broader umbrella that encompasses all sorts of fiction that includes science fiction, fantasy, and horror. So just imagine it's a sequence, or it's a story that has elements that are unreal or different than what you would see in traditional literary fiction, which is based primarily or focuses on realism.
And so just give us an overview of this anthology, Weird World War III, how the idea, sort of the genesis of the project, and who's involved and so forth.
Sure. So at a very high level, the anthology is, the easiest way to think about it is Tom Clancy meets Stephen King. So it imagines or asks the question, if the United States had fought World War III with the Soviet Union, what are some of the possibilities of what could have happened? And these possibilities range from science fictional situations to fantasy situations to a bit of both in horror situations. Some of these stories, and by the way, it's an anthology, so it's written by a number of some of the leading science fiction, horror, and fantasy authors. Ranging from David Drake, who's an expert in military science fiction, to a prominent horror writer who's a Bram Stoker Award-winning author like John Langan, whose story examines conflict on the moon. So that's the broad premise behind the idea. And there's 19 short stories by a total of 21 different authors. In terms of the genesis of the idea, it started back more than 20 years ago when I was a lieutenant in the U.S. Army. I was stationed at a place called the National Training Center in the Mojave Desert. And it was an area the size of the state of Rhode Island, about 1,000 square miles. And the primary purpose of that installation was to train U.S. forces for combat. And initially it was set up to handle scenarios across the plains of Central Europe against the Soviets primarily. And I was trained as an armor officer to know the Soviet doctrine and tactics like the back of my hand. And my role as part of the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, which is the unit that was there, was to simulate the strongest peer competitor that we had at the time. And when I was there, it was a little bit after the Cold War had ended. And they were still the best doctrine and tactics that we had available. So, you know, I had trained in these big force-on-force battles, 5,000 people, you know, 200 tanks on either side. And, you know, it was instrumented. We had kind of a laser tag situation so that you could actually count who was hit, who was killed, et cetera. And, you know, that's kind of where my deep understanding of Russian doctrine and tactics came from. So that's part of the equation. That's the kind of the Tom Clancy sort of what-if scenarios. The second part of the equation is the speculative fiction element that we talked about at the very beginning. And that started back in 2011 when I really started taking a serious attempt at writing and submitting short stories. As you know, I'm also a speculative fiction writer, have over 40 short stories published in various publications. And one of the things that I did in order to really get good at writing and things like that is I entered this contest called the Writers of the Future Contest. It's a contest that's completely anonymous. Anybody can enter. The website you can go to enter, it's writersofthefuture.com. And I entered that many times in order to become a better writer. And throughout the process, even if you don't win the contest, you could enter every quarter and you get feedback sometimes. You get, you know, honorable mention, et cetera. And when, as a writer, when you're first submitting new stories, you have no idea, you know, if you're any good. So you get really good feedback, and it really helped me, you know, inspire me to do this, do all this good stuff. So what ultimately ended up happening was I won the contest. There's 12 winners each year. And as part of the contest, you go to Hollywood. You meet some of the greats in science fiction and fantasy, like Mike Resnick, who has a story in the anthology. And, you know, I was really inspired by that. So I wanted to create, you know, meld those two things together. And by the way, winners also appear in a book called L. Ron Hubbard Presents Writers of the Future. And that was my first professional publication, so to speak. So at the end of the day, I wanted to meld those speculative elements with some of the things that, I learned as a young lieutenant, an armor officer at the National Training Center, but also I wanted to include some of the stranger aspects and weirder aspects of the Cold War, in some cases that, you know, were stranger than fiction. And, you know, that's, you know, as an example, Project Stargate, you had Project Blue Book, you had all sorts of really interesting tidbits of the Cold War, some of which were inspirations for some of the stories in the anthology.
Right. So some of these stories, I guess, were inspired by declassified CIA documents that you saw. So give me an example. You mentioned Stargate and Blue Book. I don't know where you want to begin, but give us an example of something that occurred during the Cold War that you learned about through these CIA declassified documents that really, I guess, kind of threw you for a loop.
Yeah. So the most obvious example, there was a number of projects that focused on, you know, extrasensory perception, remote viewing, and a number of other things. And all these, all these documents are declassified. You can go to the CIA website. Anybody can go through them. But what really fascinated me is back in the late, it's kind of started in the tail end of the 1970s. You know, at the time, you know, we were focused on, you know, making sure that we, you know, maintained the missile gap between the Russians, who were rapidly, or the Soviets, who were rapidly closing that gap over time. Their technology was becoming much better. Their missiles were becoming much more, you know, accurate in terms of, you know, for ICBMs. So there, you know, it was a time of intense focus on making sure that our country had the intelligence it needed, and any edge that we could get, we were willing to look at and take. So one of the projects that the U.S. military looked at, it began with something called Project Gondola Wish. And what Gondola Wish was a survey of all our major adversaries and sorts of psychic research and ESP and some of the programs that they were working on. And through the course of this project, people on the U.S. side became very nervous because what the Russians were doing was, you know, fairly extensive, had ranged all the way back to at least the 1920s, if memory serves well. And you had all sorts of different, you know, things. You had, for, you know, Kirlian photography was one of the things that, you know, they looked at, which was kind of photographing auras and things like that. But they were also concerned about, you know, ESP, remote viewing, things like that. So that ended up being perceived, you know, followed by a number of other programs, ranging from Sunstreak, Centerlane, and ultimately culminating in Stargate. And one of the more successful programs that they ran was, you know, a technique called remote viewing. And, you know, in 1995, the CIA, you know, issued a report, said that $20 million over the course of a period of time was spent on this program. It was a time of, you know, budget cuts. It was kind of the, you know, tail end of the Cold War. There were a number of books that came out kind of that in that time frame. I think Jim Mars may have published one of them. There's another book by David Morehouse called Psychic Warrior that goes into his experiences. But, you know, there was a program or a unit centered at Fort Meade, and there may have been others, but the, you know, the one that I know most about was there, and they used this technique called remote viewing. And what remote viewing was an analytical, well, not an analytical technique, but a technique that made use of this capability that, you know, apparently every human being had, which involves seeing at a distance. It was developed by, you know, two physicists, I believe. One was Harold Puthoff, the other was Russell Targ at the SRI, which is the Stanford Research Institute. And it was originally, I believe, developed for the CIA and then ultimately used by U.S. military intelligence, particularly, you know, U.S. Army. I think there was a program at INSCOM, a number of other places. And, you know, these techniques, you know, kind of blended a bit of, you know, kind of the military discipline where it had a very defined process where you would get an envelope, it would have your coordinates, someone would read off your coordinates, and then you would start to describe what your target is. The remote viewers would not be given or told what they were looking for in order not to corrupt the process. So there were a number of successes in these particular programs, and there were a number of kind of inconclusive, you know, scenarios. Now, people who participated in the program, like David Morehouse, you know, claim that the rate of success was, you know, extremely high. But when the CIA tried to shut it down, so to speak, in 1995, you know, there were claims it was a pseudoscience. There were also claims that, you know, that the level of success was not as great as other folks had claimed. And then it, you know, kind of just went to die. But, it, you know, if you believe some of the, you know, the stories that, you know, that are in these declassified documents, there's, you know, there's reason to believe that it was, you know, relatively successful. So that's, you know, that's one thing that really fascinated me about looking at these programs, because at the end of the day, if there's a technique that allows you to observe, you know, your global adversaries passively without detection, that's something that you know from an intelligence perspective is extremely valuable. Additionally, if anybody has the capability to do it through training, it's also something that you would want to keep intensely secret. Otherwise, you know, if you're in the business of keeping secrets, it makes it much harder for you to keep secrets. So, you know, that's, and then there's a lot more detail about, you know, some of the things that happened. There was one remote viewer, his name was Pat Price. And, you know, in order to kind of demonstrate the effectiveness of this particular technique, there's a story that he was able to observe a highly classified NSA facility in West Virginia, where he, you know, got to the level of detail of reading off individual projects in file cabinets in this highly classified location. And the remote viewing event there, you know, he was not asked to go to that facility, but he did nonetheless. and what he told the CIA, was highly alarming, in the sense that it was, so accurate that it subsequently became a problem. At some time kind of after, I don't know if it was this particular event or sequence of events, but he died of under suspicious circumstances. Nominally it was coronary trouble, but the day that he died, he kind of warned somebody that he may have known too much, he may have made some enemies. But anyway, there's a lot of stories out there that lend credence to all this stuff. But kind of explain both sides, the CIA kind of declared this as a pseudoscience.
Right, and the Pentagon said they ended the program, but people like Russell Targ, who I've spoken with a number of times, and Hal Puthoff, you mentioned, Ingo Swann, they would probably swear on their deathbeds. Well, Ingo Swann no longer with us, but that this, I mean, in fact, Russell Targ said ESP is there's more proof for ESP than there is that bare aspirin cures headaches. I think is the quote, if I'm remembering correctly. But so what do you think? Did the Pentagon end the program because they were embarrassed when it was leaked that they were engaged in this kind of activity? Or did it simply go underground? Are they continuing to fund it? What do you think?
So there are two possibilities. And understanding kind of the context of those times is also important. So the first possibility is it is what the CIA says it is. So what the CIA did is they commissioned a independent company. Its initials were it was AIR, AIR. I forget what the what that stood for, but they examined the program. The program supposedly cost $20 million, and it was at the end of the Cold War when there were a lot of budget cuts, and a program like that was less hard science and more soft science and with allegations of pseudoscience would less likely survive kind of a series of budget cuts. So that's one possibility. The second possibility is under the guise of that, umbrella description, which is very credible. The one thing that could lead you to believe that that's more of a cover story is because of the timing. And as I mentioned earlier, you had folks coming out with books, whistleblowers, not necessarily whistleblowers, but people who are talking about the effectiveness of this program were coming out at the same time. And, the military's program at the time was being, not necessarily canceled, but was being canceled, but also migrated to the CIA. So the CIA was doing this examination of the data behind the program before assuming control of it. At the same time, or throughout this period, there were also other independent organizations that were looking at remote viewing as well as other ESP-related disciplines. And, for instance, you have the Princeton Anomalies Research program. It was called PEAR, P-E-A-R. And they did a little bit more of an empirical analysis of the impact of these sorts of studies, and they got to a highly statistically significant level saying that these sorts of things existed. At the same time,
Sean, I've got to jump in here. We'll pick this up on the other side and continue to delve into some of the esoteric ways in which war may be waged. Some of it gets into the sort of the paranormal and supernatural. Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. Air taxis could soon fill the skies of Orlando, Florida, as a German aviation firm is seeking tax incentives from the city to build a 56,000 square foot transportation hub with takeoff and landing areas. Lilium Aviation plans to bring its 5 passenger flying vehicles to the Lake Nona community, which would be a stepping stone to constructing a massive transportation network across the nation. The facility, which totals to a $25 million investment, would also create 143 new jobs in 2025, the date set for operation. The jet is a vertical takeoff aircraft powered by 36 all-electric engines and is said to be 6 to 7 times quieter than a helicopter at takeoff. You can read more about this story in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. And tonight on Coast, Saturday or Sunday night into Monday morning, I'll be back in the air chair along with scientist Dr. Richard Allen Miller, a pioneer in the annals of metaphysical and paranormal exploration. He's kind of a real-life Fox Mulder, and he'll talk about how metaphysics is not about magical illusions, but is real magic, or what you might call sleight of mind. In the second half, there's a sinister wickedness encompassing our country. It doesn't fit any profile, doesn't lend to predictability, and it strikes without warning. Filmmaker Josh Peck tackles the difficult topic of child sex trafficking, and he'll be here to expose the true depths of this evil. Back to more of my conversation with Sean Patrick Hazlett as we delve into Weird World War III right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We're here with Sean Patrick Hazlett, the editor of the anthology Weird World War III, a collection of short stories that delves into the idea of, or speculates about, how a war between the United States and the Soviet Union during that Cold War era may have been fought in a number of esoteric ways. We talked about remote viewing, Sean. What about the whole idea of psychic soldiers, sort of popularized in that movie Men Who Stare at Goats? So, you know, the ability to walk through walls or even to kill someone remotely, let's say, I don't know, stopping their heart just by thinking about it, that sort of thing. Do you delve into that, or do any of the writers in the anthology tackle that subject?
That specific subject is tackled by Eric James Stone. He writes a great story where the U.S. government, there's a war or a covert war going on between the Soviet Union and the U.S. where we're assassinating each other's leaders in a way that has high plausible deniability. And the subject of the story is a woman who is being trained against her will to develop these capabilities to the point where they start with chimps, and then they start having her take out, you know, different officials, and over time it escalates. And it is a phenomenal story. I don't want to give too much away, but absolutely, there's a story that focuses on that specific topic. There's also stories that delve off in other directions. So, as an example, one takes a look at Everett's many worlds theory. So, you know, for viewers in quantum mechanics, you know, there is a you know, a view based on the mathematics that in a quantum mechanical world, you know, there are, you know, potentially infinite number of you know, possibilities. You know, so as an example, when you have an electron, you fire that electron through an electric field, it has a wave function, you know, the Schrodinger's wave function, right? And you don't know whether or not it's going to spin up or spin down. But as it goes through that electric field, that reality, that wave function collapses into one possibility, which is, you know, you view that electron spinning up. But there's another reality that is instantly created at the same time, where there's another you that views that electron spinning down. And that's kind of the genesis behind, you know, we're all quantum mechanical systems, so, you know, there's all these branching off. So there's that kind of topic that we explore. And there's one story by Brian Trent that, you know, called Shadow Rook One. And what that looks at is it imagines if there is a parallel universe that's adjacent to ours that the Soviets figure out how to exploit. Now, that parallel universe, there's a kind of a mirror Earth called Arali, which is, you know, based on the Sumerian name of their underworld. And in that particular story, the Soviets figure out how to transport troops to this mirror world, which is effectively dead. There's no life there. but they can transport troops to locations in that world that mirror places in our world, and then can end up with forces behind enemy lines. And the genesis of the story is this special unit, they're called Shadow Rooks, which is kind of like another special operations command in the U.S., that is able to also jump into this world, too, and fight the Russians. So, you know, there are other areas that are explored like this. There's also, and that's kind of, you know, kind of more on the science fictional side. There's also, you know, fantasy slash horror topics. I mentioned David Drake at the beginning of this, beginning of the show. What he explores is what if the Soviets work with inhuman entities like demons to infiltrate the U.S. military by possessing soldiers and trying to get into the United States and cause all sorts of havoc. How would you try, like, what would the U.S. do? How would you identify those agents, so those inhuman agents, so to speak, before they cause a tremendous amount of damage? So those are just, you know, two of you know, many of these 19 different stories that look at different aspects of the Cold War and you know, really interesting ways that things could have branched off.
I just wanted to circle back to the idea, you know, psychic soldiers and the inspiration for the men who stare at goats. There was, I believe, something called the First Earth Battalion. It was an authorized military unit, but I don't know, you know, how closely the First Earth Battalion in the movie sort of mirrored reality or approximated reality. What do you know about the First Earth Battalion, and what was the purpose?
I don't know much about the First Earth Battalion, but I do know that, you know, or at least the depictions of, I think they had a little, you know, a few things about remote viewing in that particular movie that you know, fit a little bit more toward Hollywood versus kind of what, you know, what kind of remote viewing really looked like. But again, the other thing to note about, you know, Hollywood and, you know, the media and things like that, you know, U.S. intelligence agencies are all over that sort of stuff as well. So when I watched that movie, it felt like it was intention, you know, it was intentionally kind of a tongue-in-cheek. It had a tongue-in-cheek feel to it. It was kind of a bit of a comedy in order to kind of discredit anybody who was involved in anything remotely related to this sort of stuff. In fact, it's almost as if, you know, if I put my skeptical hat on, right, it felt like there is a chance, and I don't know, I don't have any evidence of this, and I don't have any, independent research to back it up. But if I were cynical, it feels like a portion of a disinformation campaign intended to discredit anybody who had any hand in anything remotely like that. So at least that's my opinion there. In terms of other psychic soldier sort of stories in the anthology, there's another one by Brad Torgerson, and there's one by Sarah Hoyt. So Sarah Hoyt had a story that was much closer to the Stargate program, but rather than just the ESP kind of observing things at a distance, there's a little bit more of a, you know, astral projection sort of a feel to it. In terms of, you know, Brad Torgerson is also similar to that. Again, both inspired by, you know, the Soviets or rogue elements within the Soviet Union that attempted to, gain an edge in the psychic or astral, you know, astral plane or psychic domain, whatever you want to call it. So, you know, there are plenty of stories about psychic soldiers like that.
You mentioned demons and recruiting demons in war. And there is a story, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but Jack Parsons, who was the founder or co-founder of Jet Propulsion Laboratory, was said to have performed, I guess it was Aleister Crowley's Babylon working ritual, in an attempt to bring some sort of an entity through a portal. Some have speculated that if that in fact occurred, that may have been because of the timing in the late 1940s, it may have been in fact responsible for the modern day UFO phenomenon, that whatever came through that portal were in fact now being sort of classified as extraterrestrials when in fact they're demonic. But tell me about the actual role, the historical role of Aleister Crowley and his occult practices. I think it dates back to the Second World War.
Yeah, so my understanding of what Aleister Crowley did was he was a bit of a double agent. So he, you know, it came to the U.S., but also putatively kind of worked with the Germans, quote unquote, against the British, in a way that kind of just wasted their time. And I think there was something that he was doing, with a submarine in New York Harbor, or kind of outside of New York, which it just kind of confused and kind of kept the Germans at bay, help the British. And he kind of joked that, he was just, kind of wasting their time and having a bit of a good time with it. But as you know, the Nazis had, a number of, huge fascination with the occult, which would, make it a good intelligence operation to kind of tie them up in those sorts of things. Even the whole Aryan philosophy, there was, there's a view about a race, an ancient race called the Vril. I think it's V-R-I-L, the Germans, the Nazis had some crazy theory that they were in contact with this, civilization, and there are lots of apocryphal stories about, there was a craft called, I forget what the name in German is, like the Bell, or something like that, which was, either attempt at building a flying saucer or, some contact with extraterrestrials. And there's also apocryphal stories about, having a base on, in Antarctica and beyond. So there's a lot of lore about that sort of thing. And, if Weird World War III does well, that's, that and many other topics could be in future anthologies that would examine these sorts of things in Weird World War II or Weird World War I. So, there's a lot of stuff on the side like that. And there's also, as you know, the phenomena of Foo Fighters, right? In World War II, there were a lot of, reports of aircraft being followed by unidentified flying objects, which they at the time they called, Foo Fighters. So, and then to your point, when you're talking about portals and things like that, you talk about kind of the Roswell incident, right, which happened, I believe it's 1949. You're talking 4 years.
47, after, yeah. 47.
So two years after the detonation of, first the Trinity tests and then the use of atomic weapons over, two atomic weapons over Japan. If Roswell has really happened, and you could come up with a thesis that when you unleash that amount of energy that you would in fusing or in splitting the atom. It's almost as if you sent a beacon out into the universe to tell people that, or to tell other civilizations that, look, we're here. And there, there could be other things related to, opening portals and who knows at what happens if we're operating with forces that we don't fully understand, then, you know, at the time, you know, everybody believed that they fully understood these forces. But maybe there's something that we still don't know yet, right? We're still trying to figure quantum mechanics out. We're still, you know, trying to understand, you know, there's still a lot of debates over, you know, very abstruse, you know, ways that the universe works and how gravity works. If we just, you know, finally just discovered that gravity is a wave. There were theories about it and things like that, but it was only just recently, you know, determined through experimental physicists kind of determined it. And people, I think Kip Thorne and his team won a Nobel Prize because of it. And that's only recently. It's in the last like 3 or 4 years.
I know that General Patton, for example, was very superstitious and you know, believed in past lives and things like that. I'm just wondering whether any modern sort of military officers, you know, might utilize things like numerology or astrology when in incorporating those into, you know, their battle plans.
I don't know if there was any modern general who did it, and if he or she did, they certainly wouldn't. You know, the military is extremely conservative organization, and I would say it's probably become even more conservative over time, and it's also moved in a much more technological direction. Even intelligence, SIGINT, all that stuff, the U.S. military has definitely converged or shot off in that direction. Even the way that we look at satellite photos, and it's become much more scientific. I would say, you know, most likely the last time, you know, there was a general, I think, Stupelbeam, or Bime, I'm probably mispronouncing his name, was a general in the DIA in the kind of 1980s, who was really a strong proponent of the Stargate program. And, you know, he looked at a number of other things too, and it got to the point where, you know, he was leading a large number of units, and he was spending an inordinate amount of his time on this, more of this esoteric, or what his peers would call esoteric stuff. As an example, I think he would hold, and again, this is what you can find on the, you know, declassified site, but he would have.
Sean, sorry for the interruption. I'm gonna get you to hold on to that story. When we come back, we'll pick up on that. Here's Ringo Starr taking us into the break with It Don't Come Easy on Coast to Coast AM.